William Berner was convicted of manslaughter on Monday, March 24, 1884. He was ushered out of the courtroom and held in the jail until he was scheduled to be sentenced, then transported to the state penitentiary in Columbus. Under ordinary circumstances, this would be simple. The handcuffed prisoner, accompanied by criminal court clerk Joe Moses and two or three officers, would just go to one of the downtown stations and board a train. But this was no ordinary circumstances. Calls for a public indignation meeting began immediately after the sentencing. At this point, whether some large public meeting is going to take place or not is unclear initially, and no one could predict the outcome of it, even if it happens. But indignation meetings can turn into vigilante lynch mobs. As the days passed, the danger of transporting Berner grew. And on Friday, Sheriff Hawkins and court clerk Joe Moses agreed on a plan. When the public was outraged over a verdict near Ashland, Kentucky, the prisoner was taken to Lexington by a train that was heavily guarded by National Guard troops. But the train was still attacked by a mob that was so big that it posed a threat, even to a train full of National Guardsmen. I'm not sure whose idea it was, but somebody suggested taking the opposite approach here, and every official involved ran with the idea. How many policemen or soldiers would be used to ensure Berner's safe transport to Columbus? The answer would be none. Zero. Rather than surround him with deputies or soldiers, they were going to make the trip armed merely with nonchalance. They were going to sneak him there in plain sight. On Friday, Judge Matthews sentences Berner to 20 years, the maximum penalty for manslaughter. Shortly after, a deputy jail watchman named Dominic DeVoto changes into plain clothes, and he pulls a wagon around to the jail, and Berner is casually directed to get into it. He's also in plain clothes, and he is not handcuffed. Trusting that he won't just jump out and run, DeVoto winds the wagon through and out of the city to Linwood. Now, today, Linwood is just a neighborhood on the east side of Cincinnati. But back then, it was a small village east of downtown that had a small train station. DeVoto and Berner board the train there, and they take seats. The plan is to get to Loveland, Ohio, about 14 miles north, without drawing attention. Then they're supposed to meet Moses and the rest of the group and proceed to Columbus. But the plan goes awry almost immediately. A courthouse employee recognizes Berner. And out of pure shock, rather than any kind of malice, he blurts out, "There is Berner!" DeVoto freaks out, and he waves the guy over, and he tells him to shut up. But it alerts some other people on the train, and they begin to whisper. By the time the train pulls into the Loveland station, some of the people who get off suspect Berner's real identity. In Loveland, DeVoto and Berner have time to kill before the train to Columbus. And armed with the story that they're striking cigar rollers traveling to look for work, they go bar hopping. DeVoto will later take a lot of flack for this, going bar hopping in Loveland with an unhandcuffed, convicted killer. But in the moment, it is honestly probably the most natural-looking thing they could have done. Nevertheless, small crowds start to form around them, and men start challenging their identity. And these two guys, DeVoto and Berner, they don't handle it well. They start getting sweaty and nervous and tripping over their words, and suspicion grows. So when criminal bailiff Moses arrives with two additional deputies, the five men walk to the station and board the train. But people in Loveland have gotten suspicious. And it's difficult to board the train because there are over 100 people crowding the platform looking to see if it's true that William Burner is in town. Before the train can depart, this crowd grows to 300 to 400 men. They're shouting, "Hang him," and they're planning to lynch Burner. One of the deputies freaks out and jumps up. Men at the head of the crowd assume this means that this guy's Burner, and they shove him down in the aisle and they begin beating and kicking him. Now, while this is happening, Burner gets up and runs to the back of the train and jumps off. Then, when the train starts to move, he grabs it and he gets back on because he's trying his best to stay near the deputies. He's not trying to run away at all. But one of the deputies, who fears that he has escaped, sees him and shouts out, "There's Burner," which turns attention back to Burner. And he turns around, shoves his way through cars until he can again jump off the back of the train. He lands poorly and rolls, which probably saves his life because he isn't seen and he can crawl off into the darkness. While a lynch mob does a really pretty half-assed job of looking for him, criminal bailiff Moses, DeVoto, and the two deputies begin a frantic search. They telegraph Loveland, they're asking around, and they rent a wagon and they start driving the roads. Finally, in the morning, Burner, who is sitting beside a road exhausted, sees Moses and DeVoto and the deputies in a carriage, and he runs to them. He's ecstatic to be back in police custody. He explains that he was on this road because he was trying to walk home to see his mother before he went to prison. Now, these guys, they have Burner in custody again, but they still need to sneak him onto a train. So a plan very similar to the original one is hatched. This time, someone switches clothes with Burner, and he's entrusted to Ed Anthony, the Cincinnati Inquirer reporter who helped get his confession to begin with. The reporter and the killer get out of the wagon close to town, then walk to Foster's Crossing, which is a tiny little village, but it has a train station and a saloon. So while Moses, DeVoto, and the deputies are making arrangements with a railroad company, a scene similar to Loveland unfolds at Foster's Crossing. A lynch mob forms and plans to hang Burner from a nearby tree. He and Ed Anthony run into the woods. When things look very perilous, Anthony gives Burner, the convicted killer, his gun and tells him to try to shoot his way to safety if it comes to it. Fortunately, it doesn't. The two stay hidden until the train starts to leave the station, and then they run and they jump just as it's clearing the platform, leaving a befuddled and angry lynch mob behind on the platform. At the next stop, Burner is locked into a freight car on an express train to Columbus. People suspect that he's in it, but as dusk falls, it's impossible to see into it clearly. At every stop along the way, which includes going back through Loveland and Foster's Crossing, men storm the train, at times jumping on top of it and running and screaming like banshees, harassing passengers and pounding on the freight car. Finally, a little before 8 p.m., the day after he left Cincinnati, the express train stops immediately in front of the Ohio Penitentiary, and Burner is introduced to his new home. As he is safely locked behind bars, he has no idea that he's the reason that a crowd of thousands and thousands have gone absolutely berserk and dozens of people are being shot dead in the streets of Cincinnati. I'm Mike Morgan, a writer, attorney, historian, and a Seven Nation Army couldn't hold me back.
And I'm Amy Morgan. I am also an attorney, but I'm really more of a true crime and political junkie. And this story incorporates all of those things, and that's why I love it.
And this is Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre. A true story about biased media, corruption, murder, a slaughter of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops, and the cover-up that followed. A cover-up which hid the truth so well that this is the first time it's being told.
Shortly after the Boerner verdict was announced, 65 affluent, respected, and politically influential citizens signed their names to a call to action. It read, quote, "We, the undersigned citizens of Cincinnati, in favor of law and order and impartially administering justice according to the laws of our state, deeply regretting the baneful influences upon society which must inevitably follow the recent unprincipled action of the 12 individuals comprising the so-called jury in the Boerner trial, unless the people seal their condemnation upon the outrage by public expression, do hereby call the people in General Assembly at Music Hall on Friday the 28th at 7:30 p.m. to enter their solemn protest and take such action as may be deemed advisable."
This movement was driven by people who were local household names, including the former mayor, former judges, and wealthy businessmen like George McAlpin, whose giant retail store would become a national chain, as well as General Andrew Hickenlooper, a gas and electric baron. This call for a public meeting was circulated by esteemed members of the community, the rich and powerful. And that undoubtedly gave it legitimacy and clout that it wouldn't have gotten if this call to arms started with the working class or it spilled out of saloons. By the time the plan to sneak William Boerner to Columbus was falling apart, concerned citizens were filling Music Hall. Built in 1878, the building was the first large-scale music venue in the nation. It was large enough to house the 1880 Democratic National Convention and several international exhibitions, which were roughly the equivalent to world's fairs. Big deals, big things. But when people were done finding a place to sit or stand on this Friday night, it would be the single largest crowd ever assembled in Music Hall. Attendance was hard to estimate because the aisles were packed so tightly, but numbers ranged from 6,000 to 10,000.
Reporters praised the mostly middle-class, ethnically and racially mixed crowd. The Cincinnati Inquirer called the audience, quote, "remarkable for its respectability," unquote. And the Commercial Gazette wrote that both, quote, "Germans and Americans were of the most orderly and respectful character," unquote, adding that some of the best and wealthiest citizens were present. And when the first speaker takes the stage, Dr. A.C. Kemper, he looks out among the crowd and says that both its size and esteem will give, quote, "dignity and weight to any action it might take."
Dr. Kemper then starts summarizing well-publicized crimes from recent years, both regionally and nationally. He's trying to show that crime is increasing and it's growing more violent across America. He implies that this is the direct result of a weak justice system, and he explains how some communities have dealt with this problem. Often, communities have felt compelled to take the law into their own hands, including shooting a judge, lynching defendants, and shooting at National Guard troops who were assigned to protect the defendant. He says that these citizens who shot at National Guard troops were doing what was necessary to, quote, "see that justice was done," unquote. This draws thunderous applause. When Kemper pushes on to describe a lynching in Newport that we described in a previous episode, in addition to applause, one man shouts out above the crowd, quote, "that is what we ought to do."
similar calls then follow. A chorus erupts of "take them out and hang them." When the crowd quiets down, Kemper turns to the Berner verdict. He calls Kirk's murder, quote, "one of the most cold-blooded, one of the most cruel, and one of the meanest, meanest murders of which you or I ever heard," unquote. Then, saying that he wants to crystallize in the crowd's mind what has happened in this case, he says, quote, "when these men come forward and confess again and again and again that they are the murderers of this old man, and when upon their trial there is no showing whatever of testimony to show that they are not the murderers of Kirk, somehow, by some hook or crook, which you and I, as plain men, don't understand, these men have not meted out to them the punishment which the law requires."
This throws the hall into a frenzy. People start shouting, "hang them," again. Then, Dr. Kemper torturously misquotes Abraham Lincoln, saying that the government is of the people and by the people and for the people, which means that, quote, "public sentiment is the law," unquote. This brings more applause and shouting. In a moment of relative quiet, one man in his early 20s with a strong, clear voice shouts out loud enough to be heard throughout the hall, "I think we are here for the purpose of appointing a vigilance committee. I move we appoint a vigilance committee." When the applause and shouts of approval die down, Kemper resumes speaking. He doesn't overtly endorse the idea, but he doesn't discourage it either. Instead, he says something kind of neutral, saying, quote, "we are of one mind with reference to this sentiment," unquote.
So Rich, respected Dr. Kemper, is basically saying that he agrees that they should form a lynch mob. But he's using language that gives him plausible deniability. And he isn't done prodding the crowd. He adds, quote, "from time immemorial, the law has been accepted by the human race, which but the few who differ, a life for a life. Whoever sheddeth man's blood by men shall his blood be shed."
Then he tries to walk it back a bit. Starting with, "now one thing more," he adds, quote, "one of the objectives of this meeting tonight is to limit our sentiments. We are, we have been, we will continue to be law-abiding citizens," unquote.
And wink, wink. This is followed with a very light smattering of applause. Because the crowd is justifiably confused. Kemper has given this bloodthirsty speech where he has used passive language to call for a lynch mob, then closed by saying that, of course, nobody should do anything illegal. He's purely, completely covering his ass. Everybody in the hall seems to feel where this is heading.
Including General Andrew Hickenlooper. He says that he didn't intend to speak and didn't prepare a speech, but he has been inspired to do so. Now, I have no idea what was in his mind, but I suspect that Kemper's tone scared him, and Hickenlooper wanted to lower the heat. Kemper and Hickenlooper both lent their reputations to the event, but they seem to have done so with different intentions. Hickenlooper was genuinely interested in using the outrage over the verdict to push for specific legislation, changes to how jury selection was conducted, getting rid of a law that let people buy their way out of a jury by donating money to the National Guard, and other modest tweaks to the law. The crowd listened, but Hickenlooper didn't invoke the same cheers and applause that Kemper got from stories about lynch mobs.
Then a former Common Pleas Court judge named Carter took the podium. He continued the theme of legal reform, honing in on the fact that prosecutors only got 2 peremptory challenges in a capital murder case, and the defense got 23, which is something we discussed in the episode that dealt with the Berner trial. But then he used his status as a judge to assure the audience that the Berner verdict was, quote, the most high-handed outrage that has ever come to my knowledge, unquote. Concluding with a call to permanently drive the burner jurors out of Hamilton County. The outrage at the music hall meeting just feeds an existing narrative. Cincinnati police officers aren't shy about telling reporters that the verdict is an outrage, that the jurors should fear for their lives, denouncing the, quote, thieving lawyers. And one officer says, quote, I cannot blame any respectable man now for going armed on the streets of Cincinnati and taking the law in his own hands, unquote. These are the cops. Even the typically restrained William Howard Taft sarcastically says to a reporter, quote, why didn't the jury make a disorderly conduct and be done with it, unquote. The music hall meeting winds down with the formation of bureaucratic committees to explore legislative changes. Its formal resolutions are peaceful, but something has been let out of the barn that cannot be put back in. Men walk through the crowd, flashing their coats open to show ropes wrapped around themselves that they intend to use for hangings.
In the street after the meeting is adjourned, most people go home or on their way to a normal Friday night. But some of the crowd are determined to go to the jail. That is a problem because no one is defending it. Sheriff Morton Hawkins is responsible for maintaining the jail, running it, overseeing the prisoners, and securing it. Hawkins, who used to be a Cincinnati Inquirer reporter, says that he isn't afraid of an attack on the jail. He says that at the first inkling of a lynch mob, he will have 1,000 deputies, Cincinnati policemen, and members of the Veterans Guard at the jail within an hour.
Let's back up historically to explain some terminology and some groups of people, including who the Veterans Guard are. To do that properly, we need to go all the way back to 1770, the year of the Boston Massacre. When we were still a British colony, British soldiers policed towns like Boston to enforce unpopular laws, like odious tariffs. And they did it with martial law tactics. Angry at the laws and the way the soldiers treated Bostonians, an argument started between a soldier and a citizen. A crowd grew around them. People started throwing snowballs at the soldiers, then rocks, and the soldiers began shooting randomly into the crowd. Three people were immediately killed, two more died later, and a bunch more people were wounded. The incident became a lot bigger than the casualty numbers because it became a rallying cry for American independence. American colonists didn't want to live under that kind of oppression. They didn't want to be policed by soldiers. And that principle stuck around after the Revolutionary War. Founding fathers like Samuel Adams thought that a standing army was always a threat to democracy because it always made military coups and martial law easy if the military was too insular, too culturally separate from the rest of the public.
But at the same time, after the Revolution, the strongest military in the world was still our enemy. We needed a competent military. The compromise became three branches of military power. One, the Federal Army. Two, the Federal Navy. And three, the state militias. The vision for the Army and Navy is basically what they are today, plus the Marines, Air Force, and Space Force added. The role of the state militias has been much more complicated.
That's partly because the militia is composed of volunteers. That has always been an important part of the vision for two reasons. First, economics. Having a branch of the military that you only pay when you need them allows us to have a smaller standing army. It saves money. Second, it's cultural. Full-time soldiers live in barracks, on bases, and on ships. It's their lifestyle, their identity, which is one of the things that the Founding Fathers feared. Militia members, by contrast, live with their families. They work the jobs that the rest of us work, and they're members of the community. Theoretically, that makes them less dangerous to a civil population. It makes them less likely to stage a military coup or to blindly follow orders to massacre their neighbors, friends, and coworkers.
And this is probably a good time to start clarifying the term militia. The Constitution refers to state militias several related times. One is in Article 1, Section 7, and please excuse me for going full lawyer for a minute. That section says that Congress has the authority to call up militia troops to, quote, execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, unquote. Another place is the Second Amendment, which says, quote, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed, unquote.
And another part of Article 1, Section 7, says that state governments get to appoint officers and generally control militias, but that Congress is supposed to provide a framework for organizing, training, and arming them. In the beginning, it did that with the Uniform Militia Act, which was passed in 1792, just 3 years after the Constitution was adopted, and was passed by a lot of the same guys who wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. The law required every able-bodied white male citizen between the ages of 18 and 45 to be a member of his state militia. And the act required that every one of these men own a good rifle and ammunition.
So in early America, we had mandatory military service and compulsory gun ownership for most white men. And the Second Amendment was part of this vision of ensuring that you couldn't strip the everyday person, white dudes at least, from having a gun because they were a member of their state militia, our citizen army. I think a lot of people, which included me before we started doing this, will be surprised to learn that we actually had mandatory military service and gun ownership in the U.S. Why did no one ever mention that to me in American history class?
Good question, Amy. The answer is because the system fell apart before George Washington even left office. The problem was that the Uniform Militia Act mandated standards for arming, funding, and training the militia, but the states were still responsible for implementing it, making sure volunteer troops were organized and that they showed up for training, and there were no penalties against the states if they shirked those responsibilities. Nor were there penalties against individual men for failing to show up, serve, or own a gun and ammunition. So when the law was inconvenient or expensive, either to an individual or to the state, it was completely ignored.
So getting back to language, we eventually started calling the state militia the National Guard. How long ago did that happen? Was it a clean shift from the unworkable Uniform Militia Act to the National Guard system? And what was the status of all this when our story takes place?
The answer is, it's complicated. The 1792 Uniform Militia Act remained the law for generations, including at the time of our story in the 1880s. Congress didn't repeal it until 1903.
Wait. You mean to tell me that the law that required most American men to be in a militia and own a gun wasn't repealed until 1903?
Exactly. A law that never worked properly for a single day is what governed our third branch of the military for 111 years. During that time, state militias were a patchwork. We started referring to state militias as the National Guard, but for a long time, all National Guard were state militias, but not all state militias were National Guard. Because Congress never provided clear guidance, states organized their systems differently. regiments formed on their own, often filled by former soldiers. These groups would be officially recognized by the states as militias, but they made their own uniforms and were mostly social groups. The National Guard movement was led by private citizens who stepped in to do the job that Congress wasn't doing, trying to organize militias better, set nationwide training standards, and get increased funding. All those things that Article 1 of the Constitution says Congress was supposed to be doing.
Since it was led by private citizens, people who not only volunteered their time to serve in their state militia, but to help organize it better, and because individual regiments could choose to be part of the National Guard system or not, that's what you mean when you say that all National Guard units were state militias, but not all state militias were National Guard.
Right. By 1884, the time of our story, the National Guard movement was making good, plodding progress. Ohio had officially adopted the National Guard framework, including training standards, statewide uniforms, and standard rifles. And most of the militia groups in Ohio were part of this National Guard structure. But it wasn't mandatory. Cincinnati was home to the Ohio National Guard's 1st Regiment, but it also had the Veterans Guard, who were part of the official state militia system, but independent from the National Guard.
Which takes us back to this Friday night, March 28, 1884, when Sheriff Hawkins said he could have 1,000 deputies, Cincinnati policemen, and members of the Veterans Guard at the jail within an hour. It was an overstatement, but it really wasn't far off.
The last thing we're going to say about militia structure in this episode, you're welcome, is that there were three key people who could have called up these troops for service. Ohio law gave the mayor, Mayor Stevens, ultimate responsibility for preventing and controlling riots. He could call up any member of a National Guard or unaffiliated militia within the city. Sheriff Hawkins could call up any militiaman within Hamilton County, including both members of the 1st Regiment and his own Veterans Guard. Since in addition to being sheriff, Hawkins was also the commanding officer of the Veterans Guard, that would have been particularly easy. And both Mayor Stevens and Sheriff Hawkins could have asked Governor Hoadley to call up troops from anywhere in the state. Hawkins could have coordinated with Cincinnati Police Chief Riley to have officers helping protect the courthouse. Instead, beyond having a few extra deputies on duty, Sheriff Hawkins did none of this. When the music hall meeting let out, he was sitting in the county jail, completely unprepared for any major problem. Which is one of the most astounding and inexplicable parts of this entire series of events. On Monday, after the verdict, he barred visitors from the jail, had everyone on high alert, and he personally slept there himself. But by Friday, when the sentencing occurred, he let his guard down. And it doesn't take the power of hindsight to call that completely stupid. In a previous episode, we told you about a series of lynchings so that we could put you in Sheriff Hawkins' head. In it or what was not in it. And at this very moment, ask, dude, what the hell were you thinking?
Obviously, lynch mobs were not a novel concept. You could say it was understandable to let your guard down when nothing became of the public outrage of Monday through Thursday, but a flyer circulated throughout the city called for the public to, quote, enter their solemn protest and take such action as may be deemed advisable, unquote. And the newspapers were full of people expressing outrage and calling for some form of summary justice. I want to go back in time, grab him by the lapels, and ask him, did you literally not get the memo, dude?
Music Hall was and is roughly a 6-block walk from the jail. And there were an estimated 6,000 to 10,000 people at this Music Hall meeting. Colonel Hunt was the commanding officer of Cincinnati's National Guard 1st Regiment. Hunt had the foresight to anticipate problems, so he had 40 guardsmen in their armory, which was located on Court Street near the jail and courthouse. But he didn't have the authority to deploy them to guard the jail in any tactically or defensive way. He needed Hawkins or Mayor Stevens to request that.
Maybe Hawkins thought that he had eliminated the threat by sneaking Burner onto a train, because he didn't know yet that, at this moment, Burner was running for his life outside of Loveland. Although that doesn't really matter. How is a secret plan supposed to deter the public?
I can't answer that, but whatever he was thinking, he wasn't preparing for what was unfolding outside of Music Hall. Although the vast majority of the thousands of people assembled walked off peacefully, at least at first they did, a man who shouted out, "To the jail, come on, follow me and hang Burner," was one of roughly 200 determined men who started walking purposefully towards the jail. As they walked, people started to join. This was particularly true on Vine Street, about halfway between Music Hall and the jail. Cincinnati got the nickname Paris of America from its nightlife. And this, Vine Street, was the heart of it. And it was Friday night. So hundreds of men in various stages of inebriation spilled out of saloons to join whatever this protest against the Burner verdict was about to do.
Some people said that 4 black men were in the lead. This may have been true because loose descriptions match a man named Gus Gaines, an African-American blacksmith and part of the group who stopped in a blacksmith shop to get hammers and axes on the way. Regardless, the crowd mirrored the population, overwhelmingly white but mixed.
The jail was a beautiful Italianate building, had 2 symmetrical square towers on the front. Each tower had an imposing set of double doors. Between the towers were steps that went down to a basement entrance. Men with large timbers started repeatedly slamming them into the north tower door, while another set focused on the basement door. The crowd that now consisted of thousands threw rocks at the windows. Roughly around 9:45, both the north tower door and the basement door give way. They're bashed open wide enough that men start squeezing through one by one.
Inside, Sheriff Hawkins has fewer than 20 men on duty. Militiamen or officers posted outside, like the 40 National Guardsmen that Colonel Hunt had ready down the street, might have dissuaded a boisterous crowd with a makeshift battering rams, but no one was posted outside. Hawkins just locked the doors. Telephones were still rare, but the jail had them. Sheriff Hawkins could have called the chief of police, Riley, but he didn't. Instead, he called Fire Chief Bunker and asked him to ring the riot alarm. The central fire station bell tower could be heard throughout the city's core. Ringing them 6 times, pausing, 2 times, pausing, and 1 time was the code for a riot, a code that the entire city was familiar with. There were emergency call boxes all over town. Each one had an assigned number. After ringing the bells in the 6-2-1 pattern, they were rung 7 times with a pause, then 4. This indicated a riot in the vicinity of the courthouse and the jail.
By using the riot alarm, every policeman in the city learns that there is a problem at the jail at the same time as thousands and thousands of citizens do. The crowd of thousands swells by thousands more. Police wagon number 3 is closest to the scene, and the officers in it head there in a gallop. But the wagon is surrounded. Someone hits one of the officers in the head with a rock, knocking him unconscious back into the wagon. Overrun, the other cops flee. Then they regain control of the wagon and lead it and the unconscious officer away to safety.
The next policemen on the scene are 5 cops plus Police Chief Riley. They push the horses slowly through the crowd until they're across from the entrance to the jail. But the crowd slashes at the wagon leads, throws rocks, and crowds against the wagon to shoot pistols in the air. A young man in the crowd gets grazed on the temple by one of those bullets. He isn't seriously wounded, but the difference of an inch could have been deadly. He's the first person to receive a gunshot wound.
Inside the jail, Sheriff Hawkins gives strict orders not to fire on the crowd, fearing that it will escalate the violence. Men who have made it inside the jail on the first floor force open an iron gate to stairs that lead up to the cells. In the basement, another group has gained entrance to a rotunda that has a large spiral staircase up to the cells too. Frenzied men start running past cells looking for Burner. But they also just begin trying to bust into whatever cells are easiest.
Men find Joe Palmer, but he sends them away with a combination of his cool and his light skin complexion. When they ask if he's Palmer, he scoffs and says, quote, "You can see that I'm white," unquote. Then he tells them that Palmer is housed one floor up.
Some killers are more coveted than others. The crowd wants Burner and Palmer, but they're also hungry for Avondale killers Alan Ingalls and Ben Johnson. Because Johnson sells at the top of a flight of stairs, it's easy to ram, and it comes closest to being breached. A matter of minutes probably saved Ben Johnson's life.
After Police Chief Riley was driven away from the jail, he rallies with 2 more wagon loads of officers on Main Street in front of the courthouse on the opposite side of the block from the jail. A tunnel runs from the courthouse into the basement of the jail, and Riley leads his men through it. It's dark, narrow, bad place to get trapped. And on the other side, they have to bang on a locked iron door until a deputy lets them in. Inside the basement rotunda, they find bedlam. Both Riley and Hawkins have given their men orders not to shoot, not to escalate the danger. So Riley's 15 to 20 officers join Hawkins' 18 deputies in hand-to-hand combat with men who are running up the stairs and trying to break into cells. The total crowd has grown to around 10,000, and the police are far outnumbered.
Yet, somehow, the Cincinnati policemen and the deputy sheriffs manage to push the men who have gotten into the jail away from the cells and out of the building. Part of this is attributed to the first wave of men being somewhat half-hearted. But there's also just a hell of a lot of bravery at play there. In the midst of all this chaos, a young boy pushes through the crowd of howling, fighting men, insisting to see Sheriff Hawkins. He refuses to talk to anybody else. The kid's a courier, and he definitely has his own sense of duty and bravery. When he finally reaches the sheriff, he hands him a telegraph message. It's from criminal court clerk Joe Moses in Loveland, telling Hawkins that Burner has escaped custody. Hawkins curses, and he sticks the folded message into his breast pocket. At this moment, Hawkins has to feel like he has literally made every wrong decision available to him.
Outside, officers and wagons still struggle. Rioters cut the leads from the horses to the wagons, and a second full assault on the jail doors begins at around 11:30. By midnight, the lynch mob is in control of the jail offices again, and a more determined assault on the door separating the office from the stairs to the cells begins. The previously mentioned Gus Gaines has emerged as a clear leader. He stands at the front of roughly 50 men who start swinging an 18-foot-long timber. From the other side of the bars, Sheriff Hawkins loudly tells his deputies to shoot to kill if Gaines and his men swing their battering ram. Everyone pauses. The men look to Gaines, and he unflinchingly shouts the order to swing, and the doors burst open far enough to men to start slipping through one at a time. Hawkins was bluffing. No one is shot. But as soon as Gaines passes through the door, he is clubbed viciously, arrested, and drug off to a cell with around 24 other men. But there are too many pushing forward for the deputies and officers to keep up.
We've mentioned Gus Gaines as a physically powerful black man that may have been part of the original core group that led the march to the jail. Regardless of whether that's true, we're specifying his race because I think it says something deeper about this lynch mob and what was driving it. The accepted history is that it was all driven by the Berner verdict, and that was obviously at the core of it. But there's an interesting and unclear dynamic around race. First, black Cincinnatians and white Cincinnatians were both outraged at the failures of the justice system, a failure to arrest and properly punish criminals. At least that was the perception. And this may have been even more true within the black community. And Allen Ingalls and Ben Johnson may have been a more important symbol than William Berner to why the black community wanted better policing and were so outraged.
Outside, the crowd fills the street in front of the jail from side to side and north and south for blocks. Inside, officers are swinging their billy clubs and fist-fighting invaders. They keep shouting to the crowd that Berner isn't there, that he was shipped off to Loveland. But men shout back that they don't care. They want Palmer, Ingalls, Johnson, and McHugh. Around 11:30, Hawkins sends word asking Colonel Hawkins and the 1st Regiment for help. At around midnight, they arrive.
The National Guard troops enter the 7-foot-wide, 50-foot-long, arched stone passageway on Main Street that connects to the jail. It has corridors that connect on the side, including one to a boiler room, has a skylight in it that's been broken out and is being used by the crowd, people jumping down through it. A group of men, including Henry Cates, have come through the boiler room and are trying to break into the iron door separating the tunnel from the jail's basement rotunda. Police officers Nunn and Von Siegern are successfully driving Cates and the men with him back down the tunnel and getting them to retreat through the skylight. That's going on when the 1st Guardsmen enter the tunnel. Seeing the Guardsmen raise their rifles in the small tunnel in his direction, Officer Von Siegern shouts out, "For God's sakes, don't shoot! You will hit some of your friends," pointing to the officers around him. He also considers the men in the tunnel at this time more of a nuisance than a real threat. Speaking to a reporter afterwards, Von Siegern said that he could not have possibly anticipated the, quote, "piece of idiocy," unquote, that was about to unfold.
There are two versions of what happened next. According to members of the National Guard, men in the tunnel were armed with pistols and they started shooting at the guardsmen. In a controlled response, the guardsmen fired at these men in self-defense.
The other version of events is that poorly trained volunteer soldiers grew panicky in the dark, confined space. It is impossible to say which is true, but it's odd that men a few foot away in a 7-foot-wide stone tunnel shot multiple times at the soldiers without hitting any of them. Regardless of what caused the guardmen to shoot, they did. And they shot without issuing a warning. Henry Cates was hit in the chest, and a second round tore through his left shoulder. The impact spun him around, and he collapsed in the arms of a jailer, bleeding profusely. Officers tried to make him comfortable, but he died there on the floor moments later. He was 28 years old. Having come straight from work, he was armed only with a lunchbox. Cates became the first person to die during the riot.
Cincinnati police officer Nunn was also shot, hit four times. He appears to have been shot with buckshot, suggesting that he may have been shot by civilians. Officer Von Siegern received a light glancing shot across the cheek. Only one soldier was seriously injured. A bullet passed through his mouth, out his cheek, knocking out his teeth. This is blamed on the crowd, but the gun was so close that it covered his face in powder burns, suggesting that he was shot from behind by another soldier.
Here again, there are two different versions of events. Witnesses say that the troops reloaded, stepped over Cates' dead body as they passed through the gate and into the rotunda. Here, they aimed high and shot into the rotunda walls, creating a deafening roar of reverberating gunfire that terrified the rioters, who then began running out of the building and getting out of the jail as fast as they could. Colonel Hunt tells a different story. He says that the troops entered the rotunda prior to firing a single shot. Henry Cates and rioters stormed them, firing at them, and four soldiers were shot. After repeatedly ordering the crowd back, the guardsmen killed Cates and shot into the walls. There are multiple problems with this version of events. First, it contradicts eyewitnesses, including Cincinnati police officers. Second, it defies basic logic. How were all four soldiers randomly grazed on the sides of their faces by a uncontrolled wanton mob? And if soldiers were being actively shot at by armed men, why did they shoot into the wall rather than shooting at the armed men? From these first moments of the 1st Regiment's arrival, the National Guard's retelling of history will continue to diverge from both real-time eyewitness testimony, logic, and bullet wound patterns.
As the mob fled the jail, guardsmen took positions in upper windows of the jail. Others went out the front door and faced the crowd with their rifles. These troops fired a warning shot above the crowd, but a rumor quickly spread that they were only firing blanks, so it didn't have the deterrent effect that it was supposed to. The crowd didn't disperse, and some people started throwing rocks at the soldiers.
Amy reads me the riot act on the reg. But reading someone the riot act used to be a literal thing. Legally, you had to threaten a crowd with deadly force before you could use deadly force on a crowd. That didn't happen here. When soldiers started getting hit with rocks, they began firing randomly into the crowd. Very few of these people had actually entered the building. Most of them were there in protest or general curiosity. The troops began shooting out of jail windows, and over in the tunnel connecting the courthouse to the jail, a guardsman there started shooting randomly out of the boiler room skylight.
Sam Fox is a 20-year-old house servant who came to see just what was going on. He's staying out of the fray over on Main Street when, without warning, The soldier in the boiler room shoots him. The bullet rips through his arm and enters his chest.
The violence of the National Guard causes some people to flee, but it enrages others. A man summarizes what a lot of the crowd is now thinking when he shouts out, quote, "Burn the damn murderers in and out of uniform," unquote. Men move a barrel of coal oil into the jail yard and push it onto a fire next to the building. The jail's stone and it's not going to burn, but they're hoping to smoke the prisoners out. It's a dumb plan, and it gets at least three of these men shot.
Down on Main Street, a group of men break into a gun store for weapons to fight the troops. They steal some guns, but the store doesn't stock ammunition, so they move on to another gun store where they're deterred by a night watchman with a double-barrel shotgun. Other men break into the Veterans Guard armory, which has been left unguarded, and they steal 150 rifles, although they can't find any ammunition there either.
At the jail, men continue starting fires in the jail yard, burning wooden sheds there. Inside the jail, around 2 a.m., a rumor spreads that the men in the jail yard have gotten barrels of black powder and they plan to blow up part of the jail. This isn't remotely true, but it sparks a flurry of gunfire from the troops in the jail, and people start falling in the street.
Newton Cobb, a 25-year-old potter from Manchester, Ohio, is shot in the left arm and falls. Charles Breadwell, an 18-year-old carriage maker, is also shot in the arm. Both Cobb and Breadwell are just curious bystanders.
Joe Boyle is driven from his Court Street apartment when a random shot sends a bullet through his window. He leaves in fear. He leaves his building, he crosses over to Main Street, and he starts talking to an acquaintance named Jess Bright. Jess has his hands in his pocket. Two are just standing on Main. And they've barely begun their conversation when a slug blows off one of Jess's fingers, passes through his thigh, and hits James Kirk, who's standing beside him.
Brothers Walter and James Fay are carpenters. James is 28, Walter is 22. As they stand on Sycamore Street, James is shot in the leg. Walter is struck three times, taking a shot through each thigh and his scrotum. James will later lose the limb, and Walter will lose his life, but only after enduring excruciating amputations.
John Jacob is shot in the leg. George Yeager is hit twice in the leg and twice in the foot while standing in the crowd on Sycamore. Louis Kren, age 52, is a janitor. He lives in an apartment on Court Street where he's the sole caregiver to his paralyzed wife. He is one of multiple victims who are shot through both thighs. Henry Yeager is shot in the right foot. Some of the victims are pulled away by friends or strangers, but there is no pause in the assault to allow the wounded and dying to be drug off the field of massacre. Many are drug or carried in the Diebold Exchange, a restaurant across from the courthouse.
At age 18, Henry Duell supports his widowed mother and four younger sisters working as a barber. Duell attended the music hall meeting earlier in the evening. Afterward, he ignored calls to march to the jail and returned home. But the riot alarm drew him to the scene out of curiosity. Now, he watches a fellow bystander fall stricken with a gunshot wound. Duell tries to help the man to safety and is shot in the leg in the process. Like many of the people who are wounded in the arm or the leg, the limb will later be amputated to prevent gangrene.
Frank Rock also attends the music hall meeting and goes home afterward. But when he finds his apartment empty, he fears that his wife and his daughter might be in danger. So Rock is walking the streets around the jail looking for them when he is shot in the left calf.
Jackson Todd, age 32, is a canal boatman. A rifle bullet passes through his lung during its journey through his chest and out its back. He is taken to city hospital, but he has no chance of survival.
Arthur LaBoutelier is a physician who became a patent lawyer because it pays better. Curiosity brought him to the scene, but once he's there, the sight of the maimed and the dying compels him to stay and help others. While he's tending to a gunshot victim, he is shot in his right shoulder, fracturing the bone and placing him in risk of losing his arm.
In his 30s, Officer Joe Stern is a skilled teamster, which earns him a position on the Cincinnati Police Force as a patrol wagon driver. He's known as a good cop and is well-liked. Stern is standing up in patrol wagon number 4, trying to peacefully restore order in the crowd when he is shot twice in the groin. Officers rush Stern to the hospital, but he's dead on arrival. His friends then carry his body home, where he leaves a wife and 3 children. He is 43 at the time of his homicide.
Some witnesses say that the crowd fires back, although ineffectively. Other witnesses contradict this. Louisville's Courier-Journal reports that after the slaughter begins, quote, "not an answering shot is heard," unquote. The mob possesses looted rifles, pistols, and shotguns, but almost none of them are loaded. There is no gun battle. Soldiers are picking off random, unarmed citizens. Around 3 a.m., some of the troops leave the jail and gather in formation on Sycamore Street. They begin clearing the streets in a methodical march, shooting to maim or kill anyone in their sights. Guardsmen later claim that they issued warnings to each man before shooting him, but witnesses tell a very different story. Mike Shea, a 22-year-old horseshoer, is simply standing in the street when a guardsman comes around the corner of a building and shoots him in the thigh without warning. Tony Bridenstine is shot in the neck. The bullet travels down into his spinal column. As a group of 9 people are walking home from Sycamore, they are ambushed by the soldiers. 6 of the 9 are shot, including Mary Smith, who will somehow survive a gunshot wound to her left breast.
After troops walk the streets randomly shooting people at 3 a.m., the streets finally clear of the purely curious. The only people left are intent on lynching or revenge, or both. Some set the jail's coal room on fire, filling the building with black smoke. On a lighter note, a group of idiots, probably drunk, armed only with musical instruments that they stole from the Veterans Guard Armory, march up Main Street, playing military songs. A different group of idiots shoot scrap iron at the side of the jail with a stolen cannon.
By daybreak, there are only corpses and soldiers on the street. At Court and Walnut Streets, 5 men lay dying on the pavement, all within a 20-foot radius of each other, the recipients of a tight volley of guardsmen fire. Another 4 or 5 men have fallen near 9th and Sycamore. Tony Bridenstine is lifted from the street and put into the back of a wagon to be taken to Habig's funeral home. Tony was well-liked. He hung wallpaper for a living, and that supported a wife and a 3-week-old infant. He was shot dead in the street at age 27.
Cincinnati immediately becomes global news, and the coverage almost universally blames all the carnage on the objectively unjust Berner verdict. They feed a narrative that the jury was corrupt, the verdict was an outrage, and that the people of Cincinnati can't be blamed for trying to lynch Berner.
Colonel Hunt defends the actions of the 1st Regiment National Guard. He tells reporters that they, quote, "will find that most of the gunshot wounds came from the indiscriminate firing of the mob," unquote. There was a smattering of pistols in the crowd, along with some stolen rifles, but most of the handful of guns in the crowd were unloaded. And, quite notably, no weapons were retrieved from any of the dead. This is the beginning of a disinformation campaign by the National Guard that will largely stick and skew history. But in real time, on this Saturday morning, March 29, 1884, Cincinnatians know who is to blame for all this senseless death. And a lot of the city, it wants revenge. Many can't tell the difference between the murderers behind the bars and the murderers in the uniforms. And as the stories of the dead and wounded circulate, hostility toward the National Guard grows. Initially, everyone seems to agree that the trouble is over. But as the city begins to buzz and pulse with rage, opinions split. Some people, including Ohio Governor Hoadley's affluent friends and unofficial advisors, believe that more troops will exacerbate the problem. Others, like Sheriff Hawkins, believe that an overwhelming show of force will be necessary to deter another assault on the jail. And by 11 a.m., he begins frantically telegraphing Governor Hoadley, asking that as many National Guardmen as possible be sent to Cincinnati immediately. It feels like Saturday night could become worse than Friday. The time window for making a decision to avert disaster is small, and it's closing rapidly. That's it for now. Special thanks to Grab Bag Collab Network for their help on this podcast. And please check out grabbagcollab.com for more podcasts that we think you're really going to love. And additional thanks to our producer and director, Dan Fennessy. We will see you guys next episode.
See you next time.